Please be seated. As you will notice, there are only six of us sitting. Justice Prosser has recused himself. I will now call, for State v. Dowdy, I will now call our second case for today, 10-AP-772-CR, State v. Carl L. Dowdy. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Dowdy is Attorney Brian J. Cahill. Mr. Cahill?
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Judicial oversight of probation is essential. It is rooted in constitutional separation of powers and Wisconsin Statute 973-09. This case demonstrates the importance of judicial review and the wisdom of the legislature in requiring it. It is astounding that Mr. Dowdy's probation agents maintained that he had to remain on probation, but that two independent, objective experts disagreed. The expert opinions, however, only came about after the trial court ordered an evaluation of Mr. Dowdy. Two experts examined Mr. Dowdy. Two experts, one on behalf of the state and one on behalf of Mr. Dowdy. Remarkably, both experts reached the same conclusion. Mr. Dowdy was and is a low risk to reoffend. Indeed, one of the experts concluded that three more years of probation, quote, may not serve either the best interests of the community or Mr. Dowdy's efforts to reestablish himself. After considering all the evidence, the trial court took away Mr. Dowdy's conditional liberty and gave him back his absolute liberty. This is a proper function of the courts. Courts can and should do exactly as the trial court did here. It is consistent both with their statutory authority and their inherent authority.
Counsel, I wonder, you used the word astounding that the probation agent would recommend continued supervision. I wonder if it's really that astounding that the probation agent would recommend continued supervision, where I think there was something, according to the record, 105, I might be 110, 105 counseling sessions, but yet Mr. Dowdy failed to successfully complete the sex offender treatment that had been ordered. And then I think you indicated that two objective independent experts had interviewed. My recollection from the record is one of those experts had been retained on behalf of Mr. Dowdy.
And that is correct. And the expert retained on behalf of Mr. Dowdy was Dr. Kotkin, who often provides the same service for the state.
Okay.
And perhaps it isn't astounding when you consider the U.S. Supreme Court's statement in Morrissey v. Brewer that probation agents aren't objective because of their daily contact with probationers.
So it wouldn't be astounding because of the bias of the probation officer?
Correct. And that illustrates the importance of judicial review is you have people who are sort of biased in a daily interaction. But when, as in this case happened, you have an objective analysis, the conclusion is probably doesn't need to remain on probation.
Thank you.
I have a question. Statute refers to probation. Does it cover extended supervision, or is it just for people pre-truth in sentencing?
It does not apply to extended supervision. It's probation only. There's a separate statute, I believe, mm-hmm. It's in Chapter 302 that governs extended supervision.
How many people are still left on probation, do you know, versus extended supervision?
Probation continues as a alternative to a sentence. So probation is routinely imposed still today.
In lieu of any prison time?
Correct, lieu of extended supervision. You only get to the extended supervision after the prison time.
Thank you.
Mr. Cahill, some of your arguments in regard to the inherent power of the court would by analogy apply to extended supervision, would they not?
Yes, I believe they would, though there are constraints on the courts in extended supervision that don't exist in the context of probation. Namely, the extended supervision statute expressly provides that when the court modifies extended supervision, what it can do is it can adjust the amount of prison time versus the amount of extended supervision time, but I don't believe they have the authority to change the actual length of the initial sentence.
I'm just thinking about the arguments that you make in regard to the inherent power of the court and how there would be a relationship by analogy, I would think, to the court looking at extended supervision and whether or not there should be some modification there. And I agree with you, this statute would build in its own fence, if you will, in terms of what the court could or could not do.
And I don't think that the court really even needs to get to the inherent authority argument. You can rest it solely on the statutory of the authority of the courts.
Well, counsel, probation is not a sentence, so you're not asking us in any way to address sentences, right?
That is correct.
And a sentence, extended supervision only comes up if there is a sentence that is imposed.
That is correct, and that's an important distinction in this
case. So that's a separate issue for a separate day.
Though the right. Sentencing case law and the inherent authority of the courts is useful because there it's recognized that the courts do have an inherent authority to modify a sentence. There's no reason that inherent authority shouldn't carry over to the context of probation.
But it's not unlimited inherent authority.
Under sentencing, it is not. Under right. Sentencing, you need a new factor or...
And that's judicially created. Judicially created restriction on inherent power.
That is correct.
All right.
Counsel, you indicate that there are cases that stand for the proposition of inherent authority to modify sentencing. Are there any cases that you can cite that address an inherent authority to modify the length of probation?
No. Apparently in Wisconsin appellate courts, this issue has not come up. It's the first of its kind.
So automatically, then, we look to what we have, which is sentencing, as a framework for a possible analogy and analysis, then, right? Since we don't have any case law, that's probably, I mean, that indeed is why we have, one of the reasons we have this case, I suppose. Inherent power is a double-edged sword for me. Inherent power builds up and maintains the importance and the integrity of the judicial branch of government. Yet, as you can see in some of the writings that I've reviewed for today, the double-edged sword might be, if inherent power is so broad, then are we going to need a whole new calendar and a whole new group of judges to serve as decision makers on shortening probation? It's the floodgates argument. How do you respond to that concern of unbridled inherent power on probation?
A couple points to make. One, probationers have always had the opportunity to move to modify the terms and conditions of probation at any time.
Circumscribed, however, in some ways.
It is circumscribed because there has to be cause.
Mm-hmm.
There is no indication that that has led into floodgates. Second, as this court has previously recognized in probation modification cases, the expectation is that circuit courts will use this power cautiously. Probationers and their attorneys will come to learn that it's not like your probation sentence or probation will be reduced. Next, if you look to the federal model and what three of the four most populous states do, they allow, explicitly by statute, for reductions in motions to reduce probation. To me, that suggests it's good policy. They haven't changed those statutes. That's still viable. So I think the floodgates argument just doesn't carry weight here.
The statutory, we have this new statute, or we have this new law that went into effect that was supplied with supplemental authority. But that, too, again, sets up a procedure and circumscribes when statutorily a court would be able to shorten the length of probation, as I read it.
I think there's a good question about what the legislature intended with Act 38. The statute previously gave the Department of Corrections authority to do it on its own and reduce probation. I think properly understood what Act 38 does, is it puts the courts in a position to act as a check on the Department of Corrections. And what's left unanswered is, how does the modification to 973.093d affect the authority under 973.093a of a court to modify the terms and conditions of probation? I don't think it does, because under 973.093d, it all flows through the Department of Corrections. The very first criterion is that the Department of Corrections has to decide. The Department of Corrections has to move the court. What about the probationer? What's the standard there? I think in that case you fall back on 973.093a. Or alternatively, the inherent authority of the court. But that's really not the issue today before this court. Mr. Dougherty and his case arose pre-Act 38.
Okay, so you have a double-barreled basis, statutory and inherent power, right?
Yes.
Okay, so what's your statutory analysis? Or the inherent power, whichever you think is stronger.
I'm happy to start with the statutory.
Okay.
The three intrinsic staples of statutory interpretation, the words, the context, and the purpose of the statute, all support one conclusion. Courts have the authority to reduce the length of probation. The plain language analysis comes down to one word, modify, and one phrase, terms and conditions. Modify obviously means to change, but it signals change in a particular direction, towards making less severe, towards leniency, and more moderate. This is a common dictionary definition. It's a definition used by the Court of Appeals in the State v. Fisher case. And there's no reason to believe that the legislature did not intend that meaning of modify in 973.09. Now, of course, the state argues modify cannot mean reduce, because the statute also gives the courts authority to extend probation. But this ignores a basic concept in the law. Authority to extend probation is contrary to the expectation that a court cannot later increase someone's punishment. To prevent double jeopardy concerns, it is necessary for the statute to state, without leaving any doubt, that courts may extend probation. Because it is only if the probationer has a legitimate expectation that their probation could be extended that you avoid double jeopardy issues. Set against this backdrop, it makes sense for the statute to use both the terms modify and extend, but not reduce.
What about the use of the term terms?
I was just getting that. Now for the phrase, terms and conditions. The statute gives the courts the power to modify the terms and conditions of probation, all of them. The legislature did not exclude anything from the authority granted to the courts. There simply is no limit. And it does not stretch the common usage of the phrase terms and conditions to say that it includes duration or length or anything like that. For example, if you were to ask someone, so what are the terms and conditions of your contract? Chances are they'd probably respond something like, well, it's a 2-year agreement and blah, blah, blah. And this example is supported in case law and the administrative code. For example, in the case of Vignesi v. Sutula, which is a decision of this court in 2003, the court considered a portion of the administrative code relating to the University of Wisconsin system. And it considered a portion of the code dealing with job offers to assistant professors. And section UWS 3.03 states and requires that a letter of appointment to an assistant professor detail the terms and conditions of the appointment, including but not limited to the duration of the appointment. as sort of a common usage of terms and conditions makes clear, and this administrative code section shows, terms and conditions can include length. Terms and conditions includes the most fundamental term, how long is probation. And last, we also have the statutory interpretation rule in Chapter 990, which states that plural words include the singular unless there's a manifest intent of the legislature to the contrary. I looked at 970.309. I can't find a manifest intent. Certainly, they use terms in 3A, and they use term in other portions of the statute. But to me, all that tells us is that in those subsections or those paragraphs where they use term, they're talking solely and only about time and duration.
Counsel, do I understand one of the distinctions between the statutory authority basis and the inherent authority is that if it's statutory authority, the court, the judge would be looking, we would be reviewing to see whether there was good cause for the reduction in the probationary term, and if it was inherent authority, we'd be looking for a new factor. Is that an accurate summary?
I think that is the position on which the state and I disagree. Okay. I think it's cause regardless of whether it's inherent authority or under the statute.
Okay, well, let's start with cause. What would be the good cause in this case for the reduction of the probationary supervision?
The good cause in this case is the independent examination of the expert witnesses who concluded that Mr. Dowdy is a low risk to reoffend and that to the extent he does have infractions while on probation, they are of a minor nature, and that probation is no longer helping him. And the circuit court picked up on this. The court recognized that there's two purposes of probation, rehabilitation and public safety. It was clear to Judge Donald, I believe, that probation had ceased to help Mr. Dowdy in a rehabilitative sense. And then using and relying upon the two experts, it was also clear that probation was no longer necessary to continue to protect the public safety.
Okay.
Mr. Cale, I understand that the judge here conducted an evidentiary hearing. And at least according to the information that I gathered from everything that's been filed, the state presented evidence from correctional officials that Dowdy had been untruthful, refused to cooperate in sex offender treatment, had violated his probation for fighting and having sexual relationships, and was noncompliant with curfew restrictions. That doesn't sound like a situation that's clear-cut in terms of the fact there's good cause to terminate probation. Whether you use the theory of statutory authority or inherent authority. So what's your argument in that regard?
First off, the existence of cause, I believe, is within the discretion of the court to find. And I think the facts, listening to the credibility of the witnesses, support the judge's finding. The violation of untruthfulness, if you look at the testimony, it's extraordinarily vague. Examples could not be given other than he maybe said he was at his mother's house when he was supposed to be at work. And if you read that transcript from that hearing, all the examples are similar to that. The probation agents have a fuzzy recollection. Of course, you can't dispute that if you're late, you're late. We're not talking about he never absconded. He, although he did not complete sex offender treatment, look at what his failure was. His failure was he still maintains his innocence. When he was terminated because of that, he then came back and said, all right, I did it. But when he was subjected to a lie detector test, because he still believes that he did not, he failed it and he was terminated from probation and was considered to have failed sex offender treatment. Though up through the first 3.5-4 years, he attended every class. He never missed. Getting back to the statute itself, The context of the statute is also informative. The legislature used modify in both sub 3A and 3D. In 3D of the statute, there is no question but that modify means to reduce. And this is telling, because we presume that the legislature intends a word in one subsection of the statute to mean the same thing in another subsection. Finally, the purpose of the statute also is consistent with the authority of courts to reduce probation. The probation statute inherently gives courts continuing authority to modify the terms and condition of probation, to reward rehabilitation, and ensure public safety. As the court in Shell stated, inherent within the probation statute is the court's continued power to effectuate these purposes by modifying probation. And as this court said in Cluck, probation modification provides the circuit court with a means of rewarding post-sentencing rehabilitation. Allowing a court to shorten probation, when appropriate, is consistent with the purpose of the probation statute. Turning to extrinsic sources. The most compelling extrinsic source is the Department of Corrections' own regulations. Section DOC 328.17, sub 2, states, a client on probation shall be discharged at the expiration of the term noted on the court order, unless the court has subsequently modified the term and extended or reduced it. The appendix of the Administrative Code pertaining to this section confirms the DOC's recognition of judicial authority to shorten probation at any time. What could be more telling? Finally, an interpretation of 973.09 that recognizes court authority to shorten probation is consistent with common sense. And the court has directed that our laws relating to probation must have a reasonable, common sense interpretation. The Court of Appeals' interpretation is not that. It is undisputed that courts can and do set the initial length of probation, modify the terms and conditions of probation, strike conditions of probation imposed by the DOC, and extend probation. Given this authority, it makes little sense to conclude that the legislature would not have also intended to give courts the closely related authority to shorten probation. I think the court's analysis could end here, assuming it agrees with Mr. Doughty. But if it does not, or if the court wishes to buttress its analysis, the court may also look to the inherent authority of the courts. And the state concedes that the courts probably have inherent authority to reduce probation. The state's concession is based in case law. First, courts have inherent authority to modify sentences. Modifying probation is not all that different. Second, the inherent authority of the courts extends to those powers which must necessarily be used to enable the judiciary to accomplish its constitutionally or legislatively mandated function. Case law is clear that the courts must have continuing power to advance the purposes of probation. Third, probation is a shared power among the legislature, the executive, and the courts. This means inherent authority can be exercised as long as it does not substantially burden or unduly interfere with another branch of government. The courts, however, have the authority to strike the conditions of probation imposed by the DOC. Surely, if the courts can do this without unduly interfering with the Department of Corrections, they can also shorten probation. Now for the standard. What standard should be applied if we rely on inherent authority? The Court of Appeals and the state maintain, assuming inherent authority exists, it must be limited in the same way as judicial authority to modify a sentence. This is wrong. Probation is not a sentence. The importance of finality in sentencing does not carry over to our case law on probation or the probation statutes.
Mr. Cahill, question came up in the last case on inherent powers and the standards for inherent powers. When you have standards for inherent powers, can they be set by the Court of Appeals? So here, the Court of Appeals might have said it's within the trial court's inherent power, but the inherent power has the following standards. Would that be rulemaking? Or is that an interpretation of a constitutional doctrine?
I think it flows from the third part of the inherent authority analysis of whether it's necessary to the dignity and the functioning of the courts.
Right. I understand that.
Okay.
So if you say that it is an inherent power to change probation, shorten it, can a court of appeals set the standards, or does it have to be set by this court? I mean, that's the question that came up in the last one. Since you're debating that, I thought I'd ask you.
I frankly don't know the answer to that question. I think they can give it their best shot, and absent a review by this court,
sure.
It's presumed to be what the trial courts are going to follow.
But the question is of power, not whether their best shot will withstand judicial review. Your red light is on. You may continue your argument in rebuttal. Mr. Freimuth? Before you begin, you're here 2 days in a row. Sometimes the assistant attorney general asks, you don't take two cases on the same day, and we've tried to do that. Do you object to two cases for you in successive dates?
No, not at all. Okay. In fact, this wasn't scheduled.
Were you asked?
This wasn't scheduled this way originally.
Right.
I agreed to bump mine up early. Frankly, okay. I don't mind doing that in some respects because it gets all the energy at the same time.
If you're going to ruin a weekend, you might as well really ruin it as that.
Because we sometimes jockey these cases around because another lawyer has a conflict, so we try and accommodate that and move it. So is that what happened? Okay, thank you.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the State of Wisconsin as respondent in this criminal case. The State asks this Court to affirm the Court of Appeals and, in so doing, to reach the following three conclusions. First, with respect to statutory authority, the Wisconsin Circuit Court lacks statutory authority under Section 973.09 sub 3A, and I'll refer to that as just 3A for ease of discussion, lacks statutory authority under that provision to reduce the length of a probation period being served. This is true both from the plain language of that provision and from extrinsic sources should the provision be deemed ambiguous. There is a new version that I supplied in supplemental authority, a new version of a different subdivision, subdivision 3D of the statute that took effect August 3rd. That authorizes a circuit court to discharge a probationer early, but only if specified conditions are met, including a predicate petition for discharge from the Department of Corrections. Second conclusion for the court. While a circuit court may possess inherent authority to reduce the length of a probation period being served, such inherent authority should be narrowly limited in the same way as a circuit court's inherent authority to reduce a sentence of incarceration. The four limitations there are to correct a clerical error, to correct an illegal length of probation period, if the defendant demonstrates a new factor bearing on the length of the probation period imposed, or if the probation period length is unduly harsh or unconscionable. And then the third conclusion is, even under the open-ended for cause standard that Mr. Doughty advocates, whether as statutory or as inherent authority, he has not shown sufficient grounds for reducing his probation from 10 years to 7 years so as to discharge him from probation. Turning first to the statutory.
If we just said no cause here on the basis of this record, we don't have to deal with anything else, do we? Assuming that that's the statutory standard, it won't survive here.
Right. You could assume for the sake of argument
right.
that it applies and then just say no cause, and that would be the end of it. I guess I would ask the court to consider. It was surprising to me that this has not been decided before, and so I guess I would ask the court to reach that determination as to whether there is this authority, statutory or inherent.
Were you able to check, and did you check, to determine on the basis of the experience in your office, both on appellate and your office's experiences in the trial courts, whether judges are reducing probation?
I did not. The only information I have is what was supplied by the amicus, that there are a few examples of that being done.
Mm-hmm.
A few. My guess is, and this is speculation, that if this is being attempted, it's unsuccessful, or if it is successful, the district attorneys aren't complaining about that happening. But as far as actual numbers of this happening, I don't know. There is, however, I still think, a floodgates concern that is among my various reasons for my interpretation, and that is if you're going to say that somebody can do this, I think the courts are going to be inundated with requests. I know it would be helpful to have numbers of people on probation, but probation is available even under truth in sentencing as a potential disposition. So.
Well, there are a lot of people out there on paper, whatever the paper is, whether it's extended supervision or probation.
Right, and there is
or both.
Right, and there is a difference when it's a sentence and it's extended supervision, because as discussed, if you reduce the extended supervision, you bump up the.
That's statutory.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Counsel, if I could direct your attention to the language of the statute, that's the part that interests me the most.
Yes.
What's the difference between term and period?
Oh.
And, you know, when you look at sub 2, when you look at sub 1, and you look at sub 3, sometimes it looks like they are interchangeable ideas, which relate more to the length of probation rather than a condition of probation. So help me out with that.
Sure.
Maximum term of probation, but other times they use the word period of probation. In sub 2, they say the original term of probation shall be 6 months, that sort of thing, and then they go on and on and on. But other places they talk about the period of probation. So help me out with that, because that interests
sure.
me.
I think it's inconsistent in the way it's being used. The language, period, and the singular use of the word term, I think, is the critical aspect where you're trying to reconcile why term is being used in some sense to mean duration and in another sense to mean what I would argue terms and conditions as a unitary kind of principle. The actual language of 3A, for example, says, quote, to extend probation for a stated period, or, quote, to modify the terms, plural, and conditions. I think the word term, when it's used as a durational thing, is used in the singular sense. When it's used to mean the obligations and the requirements, it's used in a plural sense. And it's used actually only in this one provision with respect to talking about extending or modifying terms and conditions.
Tell me where else in here the word terms is used when it relates to a year of confinement, getting counseling, you know, no contact with the victim, pay restitution. I understand you to be saying to me the way it comes out. Okay, I'm imposing and staying this prison sentence in this period of extended supervision. Instead, I'm placing you on probation for a period of 10 years. As conditions of probation, you will have 1 year of confinement. You'll receive counseling and treatment, no contact with the victim, pay restitution. What I hear you saying is the restitution, the no contact, the counseling, the jail time, those are terms.
Correct.
And they're also conditions.
Correct.
But the term of probation is the 10 years that I placed you on probation?
When it's used in the singular sense, and all I can tell you is that I believe it's used inconsistently, at least in that particular phrasing in the statute.
Where else does it reference terms and conditions when referring to
the plural?
The conditions of probation?
Yeah. Other than 3A, I haven't really gone through the statute to identify other locations. I can tell you that I did a Westlaw search for the phrase terms and conditions, and it does appear in 323 statutes in Wisconsin, including six. Let's see if I can be accurate here before I start to give you numbers.
Does it refer to terms and conditions when referring to extended supervision?
There is a statute. I'm sorry, I'm not finding it quickly here.
Because could it just as easily also mean terms, for example, someone's come back twice to extend supervision?
I'm sorry.
If you have the probation agent come back twice and say, okay, they haven't fully paid restitution or they haven't met this requirement, we're still not at the maximum of what the probation can be, I want you to extend it, Judge. Oh, gosh, a year wasn't enough. We need you to extend it again, Judge.
Yes.
That could be why they use the phrase terms also, because the period of probation could be more than one term. I'm not sure. That's why I'm asking you.
Probation, as I understand the law, probation is a singular period, so that you can have probation can only be imposed concurrent. You can have concurrent terms, but it's really only one probation period.
But it can be extended.
And it can be extended. The period can be extended, correct. As far as the extended...
So my question is that the period that's extended or a term that's extended? And then
I would argue,
become terms of
probation? I would argue that it's the period of probation. And I think that for the most part, the legislature is fairly consistent in using the word period to refer to the duration or length. It's not totally consistent, but...
Except in sub 2. For example, of the statute, and I'm just asking you the question. It says the original term of probation shall be, and then it discusses for misdemeanors not less than 6 months, not more than 2 years, and that's a period of time.
Sure.
That the word term is used for period of probation.
Right. And the difference between the use of the word term in sub 2 there, where you're referring to, and in sub 3A, which is the basis on which Mr. Dowdy is seeking to reduce his probation period, is that in 3A, they use terms, plural, and link it with conditions. Moreover, they use it only with the word modify terms and conditions. They don't say reduce the term of probation or even reduce the period of probation. The only durational authority to change the length of probation, I almost said term, because it's commonly used interchangeably in common parlance, no question. And I think they tried very carefully to use it as period here, but as you point out, it's not totally consistent. But if you look at 3A, which I think is the critical language, there you have, just to reiterate, quote, extend probation for a stated period, or, quote, modify the terms and conditions thereof. If the legislature wanted to say circuit courts can reduce the length of probation being served, I think they could very well have said that, or they wouldn't have needed to use both extend and modify. They could have just said modify, and that would cover both extend and reduce.
Counsel, does it advance or subtract your argument at all if you would look at BM4? Here, again, I'm referring to 97309, that has 97909-3-BM4, that has the plural of the use of the word. It says, if you happen to have it in front of you, if the court does not extend or modify the terms of probation under sub 3, am I too far ahead of you right now? I don't want to... You were searching for a place where there was the plural of terms, and I'm pointing you to that place, which is in this kind of difficult statute to follow.
Right, and I see as I'm...
four.
Yes, and I see that just above that in subdivisions 3 and 2, they also use the words, they actually use it terms and conditions. Again, the phrase that's consistent throughout here is modify the terms and conditions. And I would argue, as I have in the brief, that this is a unitary meaning that deals with the obligations that a probationer has to, rather than the length of the period of probation.
Let me see if I understand your interpretation argument. Not every use of the word term or terms in the statutes is consistent with any particular interpretation of the word term or terms. There's some inconsistency. But looking at these uses, and I'm not suggesting I've looked at 323 or that you have, that you would say that the legislature uses the phrase terms and conditions as a unitary concept, meaning not duration, but everything else.
Correct.
And I may have overstated with everything else, but essentially not duration. Looking at the statutes as a whole, ordinarily, the legislature uses the word term singular and unconnected with conditions to mean duration. Sometimes it even uses the word terms, plural, to be duration, but not frequently.
No.
I'm not sure that it had. I would argue, that they haven't, at least in the probation statute.
Okay.
I can't speak to
it. All right. That's fine. That the word terms, plural, is never used in the statute in connection with probation to mean duration.
Right.
Okay. That's good. All right. That may be the only inconsistency you haven't found.
Correct.
All right. So you put it all together and you say that means terms and conditions is unitary. Term means duration. Duration means duration. Period means duration. And that's how we should interpret this statute.
Correct.
And so when you say modify terms and conditions, you're not talking about duration.
That was exactly what I meant to answer the question previously. Yes, no, that's what I... That's
what
correct.
I hear.
That's,
you said it in a number of different ways
that's what
to
I'm,
a number of different questions.
That's what I'm suggesting. And, in fact, in the sub 3BM4 that you pointed out, the amicus had seized on that language because it reads, if the court does not extend or modify the terms of probation, I think that has to be read to mean... if the court does not extend probation or modify the terms of probation. In other words, it was using extend and the verbs extend and modify without the terms part of it just to refer to the word probation in that particular thing. It wasn't, they could have spelled it out better than they did, perhaps.
I think that this is kind of a fun exercise in the sense of if you look at then sub 4, which is the court may also require a condition of probation that the probationer be confined during such period of the term. You know, so now you've got
right.
Your argument is that when they say period, they mean term, but now you have period of the term, and of course, term is singular, which means period or duration, you know, both.
I think the Court of Appeals actually pointed out that particular language and said where they had to, because of the position in which they were trying to use that, they had the problem of how to go about doing
this. This was a tough one to draft, I think,
right. That's the plain language. But if you look at extrinsic sources, I think that also supports the state's position here. The legislative history is addressed at pages 19 to 21 of the state's brief, and I'll try to summarize if I can quickly. In 1967, the probation statute was in Chapter 57, and under a provision in that chapter, that section, only the Department of Corrections had express authority to discharge a probationer for, quote, satisfying the conditions of probation. In 1969, the statute was renumbered to the 973 chapter, and subdivision 5 provided, quote, when the probationer has satisfied the conditions of his probation, he shall be discharged, and the department shall issue him a certificate of final discharge, unquote. So there it provided for discharge based on satisfying conditions. It didn't say circuit court or department. It left it unclear. Then more recently, in 1997, the legislature amended that specific subdivision, sub 5, of 97309 and said, it removed the satisfied the conditions of probation. That's out of there. And now it, and then it read as modified, when, quote, when the period of probation for a probationer has expired, the petitioner shall be discharged from probation. So that, I think, is pretty clear evidence that discharge, reduction of probation only occurs when the petitioner has been discharged. That was at least up to 1997. Then more recently, as discussed in the state's brief, the legislature did add a subdivision 3D. And in the proposed subdivision of 3D, which the governor ultimately vetoed this particular language, but that proposal said, quote, the court may modify the person's period of probation and order the person discharged from probation if the person has complied with the conditions of his or her probation. To me, that language suggests that when it was proposed by the legislature, that the legislature did not view subdivision 3A as authorizing a circuit court to reduce the length of probation. If it did, this language would have been superfluous and unnecessary. Now, it wasn't enacted, and what was enacted was just to give the Department of Corrections that authority. But then, most recently, and the supplemental authority is the 2011 version of 3D, of subdivision 3D, and that authorizes a circuit court to discharge a probationer early if certain conditions are met, including a predicate petition from the Department of Corrections, the probationer's service of at least half of the probation period, and among other things here, and the probationer must not be a registered sex offender, which my understanding is Mr. Doughty is. So even under this new version, which doesn't apply to him, at least with respect to the action taken by the circuit court, if he were to go back on probation, he could not be discharged early because of his sex offender status. Again, I think all this, and it's hard to follow, and there's plenty of it there, but I think all of this supports the proposition that the legislature had never viewed or intended subdivision 3A, in which Mr. Doughty relies, to allow a circuit court to reduce the length of a probation period being served.
We have examples, though, of courts doing that, don't we?
You have circuit court examples, correct, as you're in the amicus, correct?
Mm-hmm.
I would just, I guess my response to that is I would say they are incorrect in so doing, and as I articulated at the beginning of the argument, either the district attorneys weren't opposed to it, and for that reason it never made it here until now when Milwaukee County felt obliged to raise the issue, in part because the Department of Corrections vigorously opposed reducing and discharging Mr. Doughty from probation.
Mr. Frymuth, in this particular case, if we were to determine that there was not a good cause here for what the judge did, would we have to find that there had been an erroneous exercise of discretion by the judge?
The standard for overturning the circuit court's ruling under good cause is an interesting question, and I don't know that there's a definitive answer. If it's treated as a finding of fact, then you'd have the erroneous exercise of discretion. It would have to be affirmed unless it was erroneous. And I would argue, I guess, whether you're looking at it under the normal deferential fact finding, if you're looking at it under the normal deferential discretion review, or even as a question of law. Under any standard, I would argue here that the circuit court erred in its ruling based on all the testimony from the probation officers and the critical component of his probation being the sex offender treatment, which he did not successfully complete. So I would argue under any of those standards. I also think that when you're looking at a standard for cause, which I don't, like I say, I don't know that you need to get there today. I think the statute just says you can't do it. But if you look at it for cause, I think you have to give a substantial amount of deference here to the Department of Corrections, as is done in revocation cases. The Department of Corrections, unlike the circuit court, is day-to-day, hands-on, presumably, reviewing what the probationer is doing and how he or she is doing on probation. And I think that's why, just as in the revocation situation, if you're going to review for cause a reduction or a change, I think you have to be deferential to the Department of Corrections. In other words, the trial court has to have substantial reasons that are perhaps even without contradiction in the record to that extent. Turning then, unless there's more questions on statutory, I'll go to the inherent authority argument. I think it's perhaps debatable whether a circuit court possesses inherent authority to reduce the length of a probation period being served. We certainly don't have any case law to that effect. We do have case law that distinguishes between a sentence and probation. But it struck me that a circuit court probably possesses the same kind of inherent authority that it does in reducing a sentence being served.
Why?
I think because it's the circuit court in imposing probation is exercising its judgment, imposing terms and conditions, in some sense, and determining the length, in some sense similar to what a court is doing when it's imposing a sentence, and in the wake of truth in sentencing when it's imposing conditions on extended supervision.
But you're applying what is a general definition of inherent power.
Correct.
So you've got the case law that tells you what inherent power is.
Right.
It's very broadly stated, so you've got to fill it in, right?
Correct.
And so you're filling it in now.
Right. And I think the limitations that attend inherent discretion for reducing a sentence, based on the fact that we're looking at finality of a sentence, that the purpose of...
Where do the limitations come from?
That's from case law, as I understand it. I think most recently the Harbor case that this court handled, and it removed some language about frustrating the intent with respect to new factor. But I think those conditions come from the case law, is my understanding.
As I read the briefs, it came from case laws that preceded the formation of the Court of Appeals.
Okay.
But it was a case law that interpreted, and we've just followed through. It's as to sentence modification.
It's pretty far back. I think Hayes is the one that comes to mind, 46 with second, which is a pretty old,
yeah,
old case. But I think because of the limitations that this court has recognized with respect to inherent authority to reducing a sentence or probation, and the reasons being, again, finality of sentence and only to correct unjust sentences, that those same limitations, if there is inherent authority to reduce a probation period being served, those same limitations should apply.
Well, let's talk about finality. In a sentence, you want finality, I would think. That's what the case law says. What's different between a probation and a sentence relating to finality? Because that's one of the key points about the defendant's position, right?
Yes.
That you don't need finality in probation.
Well, I guess I disagree.
Why?
I think we're talking about similar kinds of things in terms of supervision, and especially in the wake of truth in sentencing, where a circuit court is putting some conditions on the term of extended supervision. I think also with respect to probation, perhaps unlike even the sentence, well, sentence you have incarceration, but I was going to say with probation you have the person in the community being supervised, that the Department of Corrections is in that position to best know how that person is performing on probation. So I think that although the court has the initial aspect of determining that or setting the sentence, certainly the separation of powers doctrine suggests that when it comes to sentencing, all three branches of government are involved, and that the executive takes the lead, if you will, when you're talking about supervision of somebody after the sentence has been imposed.
Right. What's the other goal in restricting sentence modification that applies here?
That was the unjust sentences. Unless there's something that is unjust about, and I'm talking here not in terms of conditions and or terms and conditions, but in terms of length of the probation period, unless there's something that occurred at sentencing that made that unjust in some fashion, I can't offhand think of something that might do that when you're talking about probation, the length of it. Perhaps you know, setting restitution and saying, you know, probation's going to be this long in part because that gives you a chance to pay your restitution. And maybe that turns out that there was something about restitution that wasn't quite right, so that length maybe shouldn't be quite so long. Something like that, perhaps.
Here I gather that that the length is too long, so argues the defendant, because the defendant continues to assert his innocence, namely that it was consensual, right?
That's the argument. Right.
And that because it was, he refuses to, in effect, admit that it's not, was not consensual, he runs into a block in finishing up his various programs, which rely on a confession. I say confession, rely on admission that you did the crime, because that's an essential element of the program. And so the judge says, look, we have a hang-up here. He's not, every time he takes one of these programs, he's going to then have to not finish because he won't fess up to the essential element that has to be done. And let's get off this track that continues and take a new tack. Is that justification for an unjust sentence?
I would say no. I would say he has not complied with the conditions of probation. I don't know that that goes necessarily to the length of sentence, for example. I also, I guess, would debate the defense's terms in terms of whether, in fact, that is entirely his behavior, in that he did make some inconsistent statements, admitting and even suggesting that the reason he did this was because he believed the victim needed sex. So he has not been totally consistent in this. I understand the concern that can arise with counseling requirements, but
maybe I've read too many news articles of somebody who persists in they're innocent, they persist in their innocence. They don't get parole, they don't get probation, and then if after umpteen years in prison or on paper, turns sure. out they were, or at least there's now evidence that would indicate the conviction was bad.
Right.
Doesn't mean they're innocent, but the conviction was bad.
And I think that's where you run into the problem of how are we going to ever know, and you have part of the reason we have experts to deal with this is because they presumably have the ability to make some more informed determinations about what the person is or is not doing or should be doing.
But the trial court here relied on experts, didn't it?
It did, and it did, correct.
You just don't agree with those experts.
Correct. I see my time is up, so if I may, just one last thing on remedy, if I may.
Yes, counsel.
Just real quickly. When the circuit court discharged Mr. Dowdy from probation, the state did not seek a stay of that ruling. So through this period that we've been in the appellate process, Mr. Dowdy has been off of paper, off of probation. If the state prevails, as it did in the Court of Appeals through this court, the state's remedy would be, and the request would be, to return Mr. Dowdy to complete the remainder of his probation, which is about 2.5 to 3 years.
Would the court then have an opportunity to look at how he's done, loose and free?
Well, I think now, interestingly enough, because of 3D, he would have to meet those conditions. That would be my argument, the new conditions under 3D.
But what about inherent authority?
Oh, under inherent authority, I'm
sorry.
That
would still be the same.
That would still be the same.
That's my question. So would the court then look at an unjust sentence, an unjust probation period? I'm making an assumption here, which may not be true,
right,
that he's been a model citizen.
Well, I don't know. I don't think that necessarily goes to unjust sentence. I'm thinking unjust in the sense of that the original sentence being imposed, that length somehow was unfair, not necessarily because of things that have happened after, but I don't have a real better answer, I guess, for that at this point.
So that would have to go to the trial court, in your view. That issue would go to the trial court.
Ultimately, right.
Counselor, I thought, unless I misunderstood you, that there was no avenue for him to get his sentence reduced under the new, I think it's subsection, what is it, 3D, because he's a registered sex offender and they don't get the ability to meet the conditions, isn't that right?
I think that's correct.
So it could only be under inherent authority if there were any reduction.
Correct. And if I may, just one last thing on that point. It's not real clear to me how inherent authority necessarily would work in tandem with the statute.
Right.
And I would suggest that it can't be something that would undermine the statute. And there we're getting again into whose call. Is it legislature versus the court?
Okay.
By definition, if you say there's no statutory authority, and at the same time you say there's an inherent power, they don't work in tandem.
Well, that's a problem.
They internally conflict, but that your position is there is inherent power.
Right. I don't know how. What I'm suggesting is I don't know necessarily how to divide that up. But I'm based on my argument. I'm leaning towards the legislature because the legislature is properly recognizing the executive branch in the form of DOC, their authority better positioned than the circuit court to address probation.
But then the argument is the legislature has no power to take away any power of the court because it's inherent, it's constitutional by definition of what a court is. This is not an easy
question.
Case.
It's
Thank
a difficult
you.
Question, yes.
All right.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Freiman. Mr. Cahill. We have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
A number of loose ends. I guess first, the standard cause or the standard for modification of a sentence. I think it has to be cause. The nature of probation emphasizes flexibility. And that emphasis on flexibility and adjusting to the rehabilitation of the probationer requires that the new factor test not carry over to modifications of probation. Next, getting to Justice Gableman's question about whether Mr. Dowdy was a model probationer. And you cite to the instance of fighting and unapproved sexual relationships, both of which occurred in his first year or two on probation. And the problem with the sexual relationship was not anything inherently wrong. It was just he didn't give notice of it beforehand. If you look at that probation agent's testimony, and it's on pages 17 to 23 of Record 54, she agreed he never missed sex offender treatment class. He never tested positive for alcohol or drugs, and he never violated the no contact order. I think it's important to note in this case that the requirement of sex offender treatment was a imposed condition. Towards the end of his probation, the only thing he was having difficulty with consistently was completing sex offender treatment. Do courts reduce probation terms? Yes. The amicus, there's a Court of Appeals decision attached to the amicus brief. State v. Bonner, it's a one-judge decision. But it has in a footnote, I believe it's footnote 3, it states that the state even would request that the court terminate probation early if certain conditions were met. As to the floodgates argument, I think it's instructive to look at what happened in this case. Mr. Dowdy moved on his own to modify probation first. There, the court summarily denied it, denied his motion 2 days after it was filed without requesting a response from the state. For most motions to modify or reduce probation, I think courts could do the same thing. Federal courts do that without any response required from the state. There's also reference made to whether the DOC should be given deference in this case as to whether to reduce Mr. Dowdy's probation. Absolutely not. This is not like revocation. In revocation and probation, there is a formal hearing before the Division of Hearings and Appeals. That's not what happened here. The only thing you'd be giving deference to are the individual probation agent's testimony, which, as the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court has recognized, are inherently biased.
What about, counsel, the argument that if the legislature has entered the field, I mean, the sentencing stuff may be something that both of us have some power or authority to deal with, whether it's probation or sentencing. Certainly the DOC has that regulation that you cited initially that kind of suggests that courts can reduce the length of probation. But the argument that if the legislature has weighed in, there may be argument with regard to 3A, but there's no argument the legislature has weighed in with regard to the new legislation on D, how this is supposed to work. Why shouldn't we say, okay, since they've weighed in, allow that to control rather than inherent authority? Am I making myself clear?
Yeah. I think we have to be very cautious with what we do with Act 38. We can't allow subsequent legislation to retroactively affect the interpretation of earlier legislation. This court has said this on numerous occasions. The U.S. Supreme Court recently cautioned against it, saying permitting the legislative history of subsequent legislation to alter the meaning of a statute would set a dangerous precedent. If we look under 3A, sure, the legislature has entered the field, and what have they said? They said courts have authority to modify the terms and conditions of probation. Sub D, existing at the time that Mr. Dowdy was released from probation, was concerned solely with the department's authority, not judicial authority. I think Mr. Dowdy's attorney at the trial court level summed up sort of the conundrum of this well. I'll paraphrase from what she said. She said, it's simply going to be impossible for Mr. Dowdy to ever successfully complete treatment and therefore probation because he will always maintain his innocence. Even if he goes in and says, fine, I did this, how far is he going to get? Not very. He tried that. And he was terminated from the sex offender treatment. He failed the lie detector and was removed. So it's a catch-22 for him. He maintains his innocence, and he will never complete sex offender treatment. He can claim that he did it and admit it, and they're going to call him out for lying. Either way, he's never going to be successful. This is not justice. This is not probation serving to rehabilitate Mr. Dowdy. This is not even probation serving public safety. This is a game, and the results are foreordained. Heads, the department wins. Tails, Mr. Dowdy loses. This case and these facts show the importance of court involvement in probation. The judiciary must be allowed to shorten probation as necessary, and the Court of Appeals decision should be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Cahill. Any questions? I want to thank attorneys Cahill and Freiman for their excellent argument on, I'd say, a twist on modification of sentence to modification of a non-sentence of probation. We appreciate your briefs and your argument. And that concludes our argument in 10 AP 772 CR, State versus Dowdy. What's in recess until 1:30? When we'll hear our third argument today.